This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my heart, I have but one desire.
Good evening. I'm Umar Pagan Ampake Pagan alongside Caroline O. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia.
One is you. No other will do. I've lost all ambition.
70 years ago today, 156,000 American, British, and Canadian forces landed on five beaches along a 50-mile stretch of the heavily fortified coast of France's Normandy region. The Battle of Normandy, codenamed Operation Overlord, would last from June 1944 to August 1944 and would eventually result in the Allied liberation of Western Europe from Nazi Germany's control.
The Second World War really is the story of the 20th century, the greatest drama in human history, the truest battle of good and evil. So officially, the war lasted from 1939 until 1945, but the causes of the conflict and its horrible aftermath echoed for decades in every direction. While feats of bravery and technological breakthroughs still inspire awe today, the majority of those years were dominated by unimaginable misery and destruction. In the late 1930s, the global population stood at approximately 2 billion souls. In less than a decade, the war between the nations of the Axis powers and the Allies resulted in some 80 million deaths. 4% of the human race had been decimated.
This great nation will endure as it has endured. We will find and we will prosper. So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
The years leading up to the declaration of war between the Axis and Allied powers in 1939 were tumultuous times for people across the globe. The Great Depression had started a decade before, leaving much of the world unemployed and desperate.
A lot of people remember what things cost, but they don't remember what they made, and that makes a whole lot of difference. You know, you could buy a Coke for a nickel or a hamburger for a nickel, but trouble was you didn't have a nickel.
Nationalism was sweeping through Germany, and it chafed against the punitive measures of Versailles that had ended World War I.
The intention of the Treaty of Versailles was largely to punish Germany for World War I, but also to create new democracies and self-determination in Europe. But huge war debts, hunger, and unemployment made it difficult for some democracies to flourish. In the end, the treaty that was meant to secure a lasting peace for Europe had, in effect, laid the groundwork for war.
China and the Empire of Japan had been at war since Japanese troops invaded Manchuria in 1931. Germany, Italy, and Japan were testing the newly founded League of Nations with multiple invasions and occupations of nearby countries, and felt emboldened when they encountered no meaningful consequences.
The Spanish Civil War broke out in 1936, becoming a rehearsal of sorts for the upcoming World War. Germany and Italy supported the nationalist rebels led by General Francisco Franco, and some 40,000 foreign nationals traveled to Spain to fight in what they saw as the larger war against fascism.
In 1919, dictator Benito Mussolini, Il Duce, or the Chief as he was called, began his rise to power. Mussolini became popular because he promised Italians he would rebuild Italy and create a new Roman Empire. Mussolini created a political movement called fascism, and in 1921 he became a member of the Italian Parliament. In 1922, he and thousands of his fascist supporters, known as the Black Shirts, marched into Rome, demanding the Italian king give him power to lead the government. Not wanting to start a civil war, the king conceded. Mussolini was sworn in as prime minister in October. Like Stalin, Mussolini crushed any and all opposition to his totalitarian regime.
In the last few pre-war years, Nazi Germany blazed the path to conflict, rearming, signing a non-aggression treaty with the USSR, annexing Austria and invading Czechoslovakia. Meanwhile, the United States passed several neutrality acts, trying to avoid foreign entanglements as it reeled from the Depression and the Dust Bowl years.
After World War II began, Germany invaded and occupied northwestern France beginning in May 1940. The Americans entered the war in December 1941, and by 1942, they and the British, who had been evacuated from the beaches of Dunkirk in May 1940 after being cut off by the Germans in the Battle of France, were considering the possibility of a major Allied invasion across the English Channel.
Sure I am that this day, now, we are the masters of our fate, that the task which has been set us is not above our strength, that its pangs and toils are not beyond our endurance. As long as we have faith in our cause and an unconquerable willpower, salvation will not be denied us. In the words of the psalmist, he shall not be afraid of evil tidings. His heart is fixed, trusting in the Lord.
This strategy rested on a key assumption that ultimately there would have to be a massive invasion of Northwest Europe aimed at the heart of the Axis Empire. This would reduce German pressure on the Soviet Union by creating a true second front in Europe, and Germany would be trapped between the Soviets in the east and the Americans and the British in the west.
By 1943, success on the battlefield and production in the factories made it possible to begin formal planning for this bold operation. The target date was spring of 1944. In Berlin, Hitler understood that an invasion would come. Fortification of the coast of Northwest Europe was already underway. In 1943, its pace accelerated and more troops were posted in the west. The Germans expected the invasion in early 1944. They knew that it would determine the war's outcome. What they did not know was precisely when and where the Allies would strike.
Coming up, the long road to Normandy. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on this, the 70th anniversary of D-Day.
I just want to start a flame in your heart.
The Evening Edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, this is the Evening Edition with Caroline and Uma. Today on Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia, we're commemorating the 70th anniversary of the Battle of Normandy.
One, become two. Get under shelter. Three, don't run. Obey your air raid warden. Four, stay home.
D-Day. Operation Overlord, the largest amphibious operation in history, where in just one day 156,000 troops landed on the Normandy coast with the help of more than 5,000 ships, crewed by 195,700 personnel from the Allied navies and the merchant navies.
Now, the road to Normandy was a long one. It was an invasion that required extensive planning. Formal planning for the invasion of Northwest Europe began in 1943. A group led by British General Friedrich Morgan searched for the best point along the coast to strike and started drawing up assault plans.
Eventually, in April 1943, at an Allied conference in Washington, Churchill and the US President Franklin Roosevelt agreed upon a date. D-Day, or Operation Overlord as the seaborne invasion of France was formally called, would take place in the summer of 1944.
In December 1943, a commander for the operation was selected. The choice was an American, General Dwight D. Eisenhower. Eisenhower had directed Allied invasion forces in North Africa and Italy. He took up his new post, Supreme Commander, Allied Expeditionary Force, in January 1944.
Eisenhower approved of Morgan's selection of the Normandy coast in France as the invasion site, but he increased the size of the assault force. He and his staff then prepared the details of a plan to organize, transport, land, and supply the largest amphibious invasion force in history. The outcome of the war rested upon its success. Now, in November of 1943, Adolf Hitler, who was aware of the threat of an invasion along France's northern coast, put Erwin Rommel in charge of spearheading defense operations in the region, even though Germans did not know exactly where the Allies were going to strike. Hitler charged Rommel with finishing the Atlantic Wall, a 2,400-mile fortification of bunkers, landmines, and beach and water obstacles.
Since the winter of 1941, they had been building an Atlantic Wall. It was a massive series of fortifications running along the European coast from Denmark to the Spanish border. Gun emplacements had been constructed at likely landing sites. Beaches had been mined and covered in barbed wire. Obstacles had been placed in strategic places to block landing craft. Hitler had boasted, "I am the greatest builder of fortifications of all time."
But the Allied forces had put in place an extensive operation of deception. The main objective of Allied deception strategy was to convince the Germans that an invasion would indeed take place, but not at Normandy. The most obvious choice for an invasion site was Calais, located at the narrowest part of the English Channel, only 22 miles from Great Britain.
The first is at the Pas de Calais, directly across the Channel. The second, further south on the beaches of Normandy, between the Seine and the Cotentin Peninsula. The Pas de Calais is the most obvious choice. It is only 22 miles away from the British port of Dover. It has gentle sandy beaches and is where the Germans anticipate a landing. But in a brilliant move, Morgan decides to dupe them and go for Normandy.
Hitler was almost certain that the Allies would attack there. The Allies encouraged Hitler's belief by employing an ingenious ruse. Throughout southeastern England, they built phony armies, complete with dummy planes, ships, tanks, and jeeps. With the help of British and American motion picture crews, they created entire army bases that would look authentic to German reconnaissance aircraft. These bases gave the impression of a massive Allied build-up in preparation for an invasion of France at Calais.
The ruse worked. Hitler ordered a heavy concentration of troops and artillery at the Pas de Calais region. In doing so, he left Normandy with fewer defenders. The success of Operation Overlord depended heavily on preventing Hitler from learning the date and location of the invasion. If the Germans were to gain advanced knowledge of D-Day, the outcome could be disastrous. Additional divisions and arms could easily be deployed to Normandy in time to stop an Allied assault at the beach. The Allies needed to devise a plan that would keep the Germans in the dark about the invasion preparations.
Winston Churchill was one of the chief architects of the Overlord deception plan, which was codenamed Bodyguard.
June 8, 1944. Hitler will face a similar dilemma. Germans find Allied plans in an American landing craft. Those plans are real, but Hitler will dismiss them as fakes. This is part of a new plot to direct misinformation at Germany again, but on an even greater scale. The plan is codenamed Operation Bodyguard. It is a scheme that covers at least 6 principal operations of deception and 36 subordinate plans.
Churchill's enthusiasm for including elaborate deceptions in major offensive campaigns stemmed in large part from the failure of earlier amphibious operations, especially from his experience in both world wars. Now, in late 1943, more than 6 months before D-Day, the Allies, aided by the French resistance, German double agents, and their own elaborate intelligence operations, began strategic and tactical operations to keep the Germans out of Normandy.
One of the successes key to the planning and implementation of Operation Overlord was the fact that the Allies had cracked the Germans' Enigma cipher.
Since the mid-1930s, all the German armed forces and intelligence departments had adopted a standard machine for encoding their messages. The cipher machine E, better known as Enigma.
By 1940, British intelligence was able to read much of the Enigma radio traffic. It proved invaluable to the D-Day deception planners because it permitted them to see if the Germans accepted their misinformation as truth. Based on the German response, the Allies could alter their efforts as needed to maintain the ruse.
So what about the logistics of such an operation? The scale was absolutely staggering. The supplies included everything needed to outfit, feed, and arm millions of soldiers, sailors, and airmen. There were tanks, jeeps, trucks, warships, warplanes, field artillery, ammunition, rations, and medical supplies. Now, one of the key supply problems was assembling a fleet of landing craft and ships large enough to carry ashore six divisions of troops in one day. A variety of amphibious craft were gathered, from giant LSTs to LCVPs, DUKWs, and specially equipped tanks capable of swimming to shore.
From March through May, 35 lower echelon and 3 full-scale command exercises were held, culminating in a full-dress rehearsal for the operation against the continent. The times, loads, distances, and navigational aids were exactly as would be used in the assault. Landing zones were selected for their similarity to those in Normandy, which intelligence showed were 900 to 1,500 feet long and averaged 500 feet wide. Mosaics showed that the objective areas would hold 1,300 gliders. The Normandy fields were bounded by trees 15 to 75 feet high, along with numerous dense hedges.
The soldier would carry about 75 pounds of equipment ashore, including the order of the day, extra boxes of matches, vomit bags, anti-seasickness pills, replica 200 francs of invasion currency, French language guide, a paperback book, a pocket guide to France, condoms, which were used to keep sand and water out of rifle barrels, candy bars, razor blades, and water purification tablets.
The invasion buildup took 2 years to complete. Much of the supplies and equipment, over 5 million tons, came with the Americans. By the spring of 1944, Great Britain was transformed into what General Eisenhower described as the greatest operating military base of all time.
And he wasn't wrong.
When you hear the sirens blow,
stop, look, and listen. Seven, don't smoke. Eight, help all the kiddies. Most of all, obey your air raid warden.
The invasion of Normandy begins after the news on Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. Good evening, this is the evening edition and I'm Uma Pagan Ampike Pagan alongside Caroline O. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia. Hold on to your helmets because the invasion of Normandy is about to begin.
This is the army, Mr. Jones. No private rooms or telephones. You had your breakfast in bed before, but you won't have it there anymore. This is the army, Mr. Green. We like the barracks nice and clean. You had a housemaid to clean your floor.
June 6th, 1944, that's 70 years ago today, when Allied forces would storm the beaches of Normandy in what would be the largest amphibious military assault in history. It would change the course of the war. It would have Hitler on the run. It would inspire Steven Spielberg to make one of the most remarkable war movies of all time.
Soldiers, sailors, and airmen of the Allied Expeditionary Force, you are about to embark upon the Great Crusade, toward which we have striven these many months. The eyes of the world are upon you. The hopes and prayers of liberty-loving people everywhere march with you. In company with our brave allies and brothers in arms on other fronts, you will bring about the destruction of the German war machine, the elimination of Nazi tyranny over the oppressed peoples of Europe, and security for ourselves in a free world. Your task will not be an easy one. Your enemy is well-trained, well-equipped, and battle-hardened. He will fight savagely. But this is the year 1944. Much has happened since the Nazi triumphs of 1940-41. The United Nations have inflicted upon the Germans great defeats in open battle, man-to-man. Our air offensive has seriously reduced their strength in the air and their capacity to wage war on the ground. Our home front have given us an overwhelming superiority in weapons and munitions of war, and placed at our disposal great reserves of trained fighting men. The tide has turned. The free men of the world are marching together to victory. I have full confidence in your courage, devotion to duty, and skill in battle. We will accept nothing less than full victory. Good luck, and let us all beseech the blessing of Almighty God upon this great and noble undertaking.
Now, General Eisenhower had set D-Day for June the 5th. Loading for the assault started on May 31st. That night, the first part of the massive naval operation began when minesweepers moved out to start clearing channels for the Armada. And then on June 4th, with the great invasion force poised to go, trouble struck.
Everything seemed to be going the Allies' way. The troops were briefed. Then the weather turned against them. Rain lashed down. Visibility was poor, and the channel was stormy.
A large storm arose in the English Channel. Eisenhower faced an agonizing decision. Should he postpone the invasion?
At 6 a.m. on June the 4th, Eisenhower decided to postpone the invasion for at least one day, hoping for better weather on June the 6th. For the next 24 hours, the men of the Allied invasion force...
Nevertheless, on June the 4th, 1944, the assault troops boarded their landing ships and the armada of more than 5,000 vessels set sail. But the rain continued to lash down. Later that day, the invasion had to be postponed. The ships returned to port, and the assault troops faced a nerve-shredding wait. Early the next morning, the military leadership met again. The naval commanders were keen to go ahead. But the air chiefs were doubtful. They worried the visibility would still be too poor to provide effective air support. After a long silence, Eisenhower looked up. "Let's go," he said.
On the continent, the Germans were confident that the storm in the Channel would postpone any planned Allied invasion. Rommel took the opportunity to return to his home in Germany to visit his family. I think he went for his wife's birthday. The first men to see action on D-Day were the airborne troops.
The bombers begin the invasion blow. Great air fleets hitting German defenses. Smoke bombs are used for guidance as thousands of tons of high explosives rain down, smashing Nazi transport and fortifications in preparation for the second front landings. Watch, a road junction is hit. A strategic bridge knocked out by precision bombing.
Three airborne divisions, two American and one British, dropped behind the landing beaches in the hours before dawn. Over 20,000 men, the largest airborne force ever assembled, entered Normandy by glider and by parachute.
The overall mission of the airborne divisions was to disrupt and confuse the Germans so as to prevent a concentrated counterattack against the seaborne troops coming in at dawn and to protect the flanks of the invasion force at Sword and Utah beaches.
Wooden Horsa gliders carried thousands of troops and their vehicles into battle.
You would not believe the sight. 60 gliders lying astern in two huge columns, tow ropes attached, ready to go.
As I was going into land, I got my flaps on all that, another glider landed on top of me. And there was a big bang in front of me. This glider that had hit me, landed on top of me, came down in front of me. And as he was leveling off to land, his tail came up.
Crashing into farm fields in fragile gliders or descending in parachutes amid anti-aircraft fire, the airborne troops suffered heavy casualties. In the darkness and confusion of the pre-dawn hours, many units became scattered and disorganized. Some men who landed in flooded areas drowned. Despite these difficulties, groups of soldiers managed to form up and attack the enemy.
The first confirmation of a large-scale attack did not come until 2:15 a.m. That an invasion was in progress was not confirmed until 4:15. It was only at 6 a.m. when Normandy's defenders saw the horizon obscured by an unbroken line of Allied ships that all doubt was removed.
The great convoys steamed through the English Channel. The landing craft crammed with soldiers, tough and hardened fighting men. The mighty armada as seen from above as a weaving pattern of ships. Those 4,000 ships as they steamed for the coast of Normandy.
As dawn came to the coast, Allied troops approached the landing beaches. The first waves included 30-man assault teams and amphibious duplex tanks that plowed through the water under their own power. There were also Army combat engineers and Navy demolition teams. Their job was to clear beach obstacles and mark safe pathways for the later waves.
Aboard the landing craft, the men were pitched about. Many were seasick. Tension, fear, and anticipation were the dominant emotions. Behind them, the naval bombardment continued, while overhead, bombers went on their work. The noise was tremendous. It left an unforgettable impression on every man who experienced it.
From the ships, they swarmed down to smaller craft for the dash to shore. There's hostile fire now. The boats reply and men duck for cover.
Closer to shore, boats began to hit mines. The explosions lifted some entirely out of the water. As the first waves neared land, shelling of the beaches ceased. It would not resume until the men were ashore and could radio back targets. Sometime around 6:30 a.m., the first landing craft hit the beach. D-Day had arrived on the beaches of Normandy.
Along nearly 100 kilometers of coast, Allied warships and aircraft pounded German defenses. At 6:30, U.S. soldiers went ashore by landing craft at Utah and Omaha beaches. An hour later, the British and Canadians arrived on the beaches of Gold, Juneau, and Sword. Fortuitously, troops at Utah accidentally landed 2 kilometers from their target on a virtually unguarded beach. The landing zone was quickly secured with few losses. On Omaha Beach, where aerial bombardment had done little to dent German defenses, the Americans met fierce resistance. From clifftop bunkers, the defenders pummeled U.S. troops with machine gun fire and shells as soon as the landing craft ramps were lowered. Those who made it ashore found it impossible to advance across 200 meters of open beach. Amphibious tanks intended to cover the infantry's advance had sunk in the rough seas.
The news from Omaha was so bad that the landings there were almost called off, but eventually small groups of American infantry worked their way around the German defenses, outflanked and stormed them, allowing the beachhead to be secured. But Omaha cost the Americans more than 2,000 casualties. When British and Canadian troops landed at 7:30, supported by tanks, the tide was high, leaving fewer meters of beach to traverse. Although mines sunk a number of boats, soldiers succeeded in silencing German machine guns within half an hour.
At the day's end, although they had not taken their objective of Caen, the soldiers had penetrated 6 kilometers inland and their foothold in Normandy was secure. At 6 p.m., when Churchill addressed the House of Commons, it was to announce the astounding success of an operation which would go down in military legend. After this, just what the Battle of Normandy would mean to Europe, the world, and the war effort. You're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia, the evening edition, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, you're listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia on the evening edition with Caroline and Uma.
Nous nous aimions bien tendrement, comme s'aiment tous les amants. Et puis un jour, tu m'as quitté. Depuis je suis désespéré, je te vois partout dans le ciel, je te vois partout.
Today, we're taking you back to D-Day. Why? Because 70 years ago, June 6, 1944, marked the start of the Allied invasion of Normandy, the long-awaited Second Front and the greatest amphibious operation in history, where the Allies would fight a bitter but victorious campaign to break out of their beachhead and liberate France.
Ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
My fellow Americans, last night, when I spoke with you about the fall of Rome, I knew at that moment the troops of the United States and our allies were crossing the Channel in another and greater operation. It has come to pass with success thus far. And so, in this poignant hour, I ask you to join with me in prayer. Almighty God, our sons, pride of our nation, this day have set upon a mighty endeavor, a struggle to preserve our republic, our religion, and our civilization, and to set free a suffering humanity. Lead them straight and true. Give strength to their arms, stoutness to their hearts, steadfastness in their faith. They will need thy blessings. Their road will be long and hard. For the enemy is strong. He may hurl back our forces. Success may not come.
As full darkness came to the Normandy coast at about 10 p.m., unloading at the beaches ceased. In a single day, over 150,000 American, British, Canadian, and French troops had entered France by air and sea at a cost of nearly 5,000 casualties. From the American airborne on the far right to the British airborne on the far left, the invasion front stretched over 50 miles.
The Germans had taken years to build the Atlantic Wall. At Utah Beach, it had held up the 1st U.S. 4th Division for less than 1 hour. At Omaha Beach, it held up the U.S. 29th and 1st Divisions for less than 1 day. At Gold Beach, Juno Beach, and Sword Beach, it had held up the British 50th and Canadian 3rd, the British 3rd Divisions, for about an hour. Fortress Europe had been breached. The largest amphibious operation in history was a success.
The gratitude of every home in our island, in our empire, and indeed throughout the world, except in the abodes of the guilty, goes out to the British airmen who, undaunted by odds, unwearied in their constant challenge and mortal danger, are turning the tide of the world war by their prowess and by their devotion. Never in the field of human conflict was so much owed by so many to so few.
Anne Frank would write in her diary, "This is D-Day." The BBC announced it at 12 o'clock. This is the day. The invasion has begun. Is this really the beginning of the long-awaited liberation? The liberation we've all talked so much about, which still seems too good, too much of a fairy tale ever to come true. The best part of the invasion is that I have the feeling that friends are on the way. Those terrible Germans have oppressed and threatened us for so long that the thought of friends and salvation means everything to us. News of D-Day electrified the world. At last, the Allies had a second front in Europe. The Germans now faced the Soviets in the east and the Americans, British and Canadians in the west. Hitler also had to contend with Allied armies in Italy and the ongoing Allied bombing offensive against Germany. Victory in Europe seemed within reach.
In purely military terms, it is almost impossible to exaggerate the importance of this extraordinary operation. Operation Overlord was 4 years in the making of hard-won experience, painstakingly acquired from hundreds and thousands of soldiers involved in just as many operations throughout this long, hard war. Overlord was the most ambitious military operation in history. 156,000 men, as many as 10,000 vehicles along 50 miles of defended coastline from more than 4,000 landing craft. Over 1,200 naval warships defended the invasion fleet and more than 23,000 airborne troops landed in support.
It is important to remember that amphibious assault landings were and remain by far the riskiest of all military operations. Field Marshal Sir Alan Brooke, Britain's chief of the Imperial General Staff, wrote on 5th of June that it may well be the most ghastly disaster of the entire war. I wish to God it were safely over. Hindsight teaches us that D-Day was a great success, but at the time, it was seen by many as an enormous gamble, a dramatic throw of the dice on which the highest of stakes rested.
For the people of Europe, D-Day meant liberation from 4 long years of occupation and oppression. For the British, it meant a triumphant return to France, from which they had been humiliatingly evicted in June 1940. Senior American planners congratulated themselves that their confident preference for a direct assault across the Channel had been vindicated. The British equally congratulated themselves on delaying the operation until the time was right.
But D-Day alone did not bring about the defeat of Nazi Germany. Remember that the bulk of the German army was defeated in the east by the Soviets. Remember that Rome fell on June the 5th. D-Day alone did not bring about the end of the war, but it was an operation of unprecedented scale, ingenuity, complexity, and risk. Above all, it was a success, in forcing Germany to fight a two-front war against, and for the first time, the full combined weight of the United States, Great Britain, and the Soviet Union. It was perhaps the tipping point that made the final collapse of the Third Reich inevitable.
But most importantly, in a time of unprecedented worldwide strife, D-Day was a crucial element of a global effort made by millions of people from an international coalition the scale the world has never seen and will likely never see again.
There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in. I want to be their boy, spread some joy when they take old Berlin. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Brooklyn boys begin to take the joint apart and tear it down when they take old Berlin. They're gonna start a row and show 'em how we paint the town back in Kokomo. They're gonna take a hike through Hitler's Reich and change that Heil to what you know, Joe. There'll be a hot time in the town of Berlin when the Yanks go marching in.
You've been listening to Hari Ini Dalam Sejarah Dunia, an episode we dedicate to all those men and women who continue to keep this hard-won and fragile peace, who prevent us from repeating the follies of our often inhuman past. This is the Evening Edition, BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.